Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everybody, to this latest edition of Pick a Flick, where you pick the film, we talk about it. Simple as that. I am joined today by one recurring guest from an earlier episode of Pick a Flick, and one who is making his Pick a Flick debut. We are rejoined by Chris Wallace.
Hello.
How are you doing, Chris?
I'm not too bad, thank you.
How is Wiki Shuffle HQ?
It's the same. I've got Phil here at the minute. He's playing Fallout. So if you hear anything, it's probably Phil.
Oh, Phil's there. Oh, hello, Phil.
Oh, he's in another room. Killing zombies or something.
Oh, right. Okay. I was just imagining him right next to you, like, just being really quiet. And we're also joined by Leslie Byron Pitt.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for coming on Pick a Flick. You're an old hand from Black Hole Cinema, so it's nice to have you on this, my new venture.
Yes, it's really strange that it's like, oh, we're changing it now, we're doing this. I was like, what? I don't know what day is it? What year is this?
Who's the president?
I'm going to enjoy this format. I like the idea. You've got some strange ones coming through, but I'm sure we'll be talking about them soon, so.
Strange is not the word. I really do. And somebody today nominated Sex in the City 2, so clearly people really want me to suffer. Okay, we have got two listener nominations today, which are quite diverse and different films, but they're curios to say the least, so this could be an interesting one. So let's start as we mean to go on. Let's pick a flick. Bullworth is a 1998 American political comedy film co-written, co-produced, directed by and starring Warren Beatty. It co-stars Halle Berry, Oliver Platt, Don Cheadle, Paul Sorvino, Jack Warden and Isaiah Washington. The film follows the title character, California Senator J. Billington Bullworth, as he runs for re-election while trying to avoid a hired assassin. Let's see a little clip of this very strange film.
It's up to you.
What'll we do? What'll we do? Well, it's up to you.
You know, it ain't that funny. You contribute all my money. You make your contribution, then you get your solution. As long as you can pay, I'm gonna do it all your way. Yes, the money talks and the people walk. You. Now let me hear you say it. Big money.
Big money. Big money.
Big money. Big money. Big money. Big money. Big money. Big money.
Really real. The name of our game is Let's Make a Deal. Now people got their problems, the haves and the have-nots, but the ones that make me listen pay for 30 second spots.
30 seconds.
Yeah.
30 seconds.
Yeah. Yo, Bank of America, this table over here, Wells Fargo and Citibank, you really very dear. Loan billions to Mexico and never have to fear, cause taxpayers, taxpayers, take it in the rear.
Take it in the rear. Take it in the rear. Take it in the rear. Take it in the rear. make it any real.
Yo, over here, we got our friends from oil. They don't give a shit how much wilderness is spoiled.
They tell us that they're careful. We know that it's a lie. As long as we keep driving cars, they let the planet die.
Let the planet die. Let the planet die.
Exxon, Mobil, the Saudis in Kuwait. If we still got the Middle East, the atmosphere can wait. The Arabs got the oil, we buy everything they sell.
But if the brothers raise the price, we blow them all to hell.
Now let me hear you say it. Saddam.
Saddam.
Hussein.
Hussein.
Saddam.
Saddam.
Hussein.
Hussein.
I want you to give me a phone number, a Dr. Morris Fishman, UCLA. He's at the Department of Psychiatry. Go, get the number now. Get it now.
Yo,
go.
Everybody going to get sick someday, but nobody know how they going to pay.
Healthcare, managed care, HMOs.
Ain't going to work, no sir, not those. Because the thing that's the same in every one of these motherfuckers there, the insurance companies.
Insurance.
Yo, you can call it single payer or Canadian way. Only socialized medicine will ever save the day. Come on now, let me hear that dirty word. Socialism! No, no, no,
no. For Bulworth, Warren Beatty assembled a team of three writers, Aaron Sorkin, Jeremy Pixar, and James Toback. Due to family issues, Pixar only contributed to the writing process remotely, communicating by phone and fax. And Beatty also sought guidance from the writer Elaine May, although she was committed to working on another political film, Primary Colours, with her former comedy partner, the director Mike Nichols. Bulworth is unique, isn't it, gentlemen?
You say unique. I think it's odd. I think it's a bit strange. I think Primary Colours, from what I remember of it, with Elaine May writing and Mike Nichols, is a better film, especially for, you know, its liberal point of view. And I think that one thing I found is I found it very difficult to kind of get on with. And I think one of the reasons why is, as being, you know, being Afro-Caribbean as I am, and having and following like black politics, and especially now at this moment in time, and then seeing this and seeing how dated and it's just full of like a white savior narrative to a point. I mean, it's interesting. There's stuff in there that's really relative, and I think there's stuff in there that's really important. But I there's just something about how Beatty, the writer, producer, director, and starring, kind of places himself in this film, telling his all-white campaigners, you know, all this stuff in Ebonics, and there's something a little bit jarring about it. Not to say that the film doesn't come up with good points. Unfortunately, they all seem to be, some of the good points are all kind of sermonized by like nearly every black character in there. But I think when it came out of the, when stuff like similar to this came out of the mouth of Spike Lee in many of his films, case in point, something like Bamboozled, people were saying, oh, he's laying it a little bit thick. It's a bit too heavy. It's really heavy-handed. Whereas here, it's almost as bad as a satire. But I think Bamboozled's a better film. I think it really strikes a nerve, and it's supposed to disturb, where this kind of becomes a little bit too heroic. And I don't know. Not all of it I kind of got on board with, and I kind of lost interest, especially with the assassin narrative.
I agree with a lot of what you just said. I found the film really very much a product of its times. It's very 90s, and it's very self-indulgent on Warren Beatty's part. It's very much, he's front and centre, and it's his story. And yeah, the assassin thing, I didn't really know where it was going, and to be honest, it did make me cringe. And not in the way that it intended me to, in the way that I felt uncomfortable with the situations that he was putting himself in, but not for the reasons that he wanted me to feel uncomfortable. It's just, this film just doesn't work for me. It's nice seeing a young Halle Berry. I thought she was, you know, she was good, but this wasn't a film for me, and it's probably not one that I would watch again.
It's weird, isn't it? In that I think you both got a lot. You're on the money there with a lot of that. I think though that, even though, yeah, it's cringeworthy, I kind of think that's maybe the point.
Yeah, I do, exactly. And I think there was times when it was telling me, you should be cringing. And if something is telling me to cringe, it's almost a double bluff or something. It's forcing me to do that. And I don't know if that's the intention.
My issue would probably be more in a sense of, I'm cringing because I'm here listening to it and it's got Praz from the Fugees on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
playing Ghetto Superstar, and it's got ODB on there, and it's just, you're listening to it, and it's not that what he said. I agree with a lot of what he's saying, but I find it really cringeworthy. At one point, you've got Halle Berry, Bulworth's trying to be the senator, and then Halle Berry just reams off this kind of political monologue, and it just doesn't feel
that bit in the limousine.
Yeah. It doesn't ring true. And then it gets to Don Cheadle, who does exactly the same thing. And it just feels, it's not so much that they're wrong, and it's not so much that you wouldn't believe characters would say anything like that. It's more the sense that it almost seems like it's that bit in Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Juice in the Hood, where everybody just stops, they reel off something, and then you're supposed to hear message just right at the end. And that's what's so cringeworthy about it. Yeah. It's not the fact that the characters are stupid. It just seems so... It's cringy on how it is put forward. I mean, at this moment in time, I wrote a review for Vodzilla, sorry to plug, about Dear White People that has just been released. It was released a couple of weeks ago. And as a satire, that is, it's far more on point. It hits the nail on the head so much better because you believe the characters a lot more, whereas this is very sort of... They're all very postured. They're all very, it just doesn't work for me in that way. The idea that you have certain characters who are coming from a certain point of view, which once again, I do find, I agree with to a point. But then on the flip side of it, the way they talk at times is just, it just doesn't ring true. And strangely enough, in terms from the Rotten Tomatoes score, was like, I think it was 68. No, actually, no, that's a lie. The Rotten Tomatoes score was 75. And then the IMDb rating score was 6.8. So it was actually well taken on board. Whereas something like School Days, something like, anything from Spike's body of work, anything from a point of view which would probably be more inclined to that sort of to what it's trying to suggest and what it's saying, is gets a lot less in terms of its ratings. Now I'm not sure if that's because of the amount of people who have seen it or not, but I just think there's a lot of it's Warren Beatty, so therefore, and Beatty's political standings and film standings, this is the guy that ushered in the coming of the American New Wave, so he does have a certain stature, whereas in this film it just seems like he's trying to get some strange from some brown sugar. It does feel like it's it's not just a passion project, it's a let's have Beatty, who's old at this point, and this is after his situation with Madonna.
The self-indulgence that I found with it, because his history is of being a bit of a ladies' man, and this film makes him come across quite badly in my eyes. I think it's a self-indulgent thing, and it just doesn't work for me.
He was very insecure about it, though. Like I say, he went to Elaine May because he was insecure about the script. Jeremy Pixer, who co-wrote it with him, said that it was a really frustrating experience because Beatty would spend months reworking drafts. And
I think maybe that's where it fell down then, in some ways. If it's taken too many cooks, comes to mind, maybe.
Yeah.
What part did Aaron Sorkin play in it? What role did he take on in making it?
Apparently, he just did a lot of uncredited work on the script. Now, I don't feel like he's... I mean, obviously, the agenda of Bulworth is very much a Sorkin kind of agenda. Yeah. But at the same time, you don't feel... When you hear scripts like, The Social Network and things like that, you can feel Sorkin in the dialogue. I didn't feel that with this. Probably because Beatty is Beatty, and he's got the biggest ego of any actor in the history of ever. So he probably just made this exactly what he wanted it to be. And hence why it was made in complete stealth, and it took contractual wrangling for 20th Century Fox to release it. And they only did it for a brief period of time, almost without any publicity. Partly because they backed out of producing Dick Tracy. So Beatty, apparently, according to Peter Swirsky, who'd studied the film, so Beatty used the leverage of a lawsuit to wrangle unprecedented artistic freedom, disclosing only the barest outline of the story and essentially duping 20th Century Fox into bankrolling the project. And to be fair, I can't imagine a studio in this day and age bankrolling Bulworth.
No. I can't see anyone in this stage, someone with the power of someone like Beatty being able to do something like that. That's, you know, that's unprecedented to a point. You know, I love that story. It's fantastic. But I think when you look at it, Elaine May, Sorkin, these are all interesting guys and great writers. You know, May and Nichols, they used to do stand-up in the 60s. But I think the problem I would have had with something like this is, it, you know, as much as they wanted to make sure it gets through and everything else like that, it's the argument that's coming through that I'm seeing a lot on the internet, where it's going, if there was more people of color, it would work probably better. You know, we've just had Spike Lee turn around. I keep bringing up Spike Lee, but, you know, you have Spike Lee turn around recently after getting his honorary Oscar and going, well, there's not enough representation in there. And it's not just they want to see more black people in films or anything else like that. It's that when you get stuff like Bullworth, it doesn't ring true. It doesn't feel right. And one of the reasons why is there's no one writing of that thing, no one writing or no one of that kind of that background in there. It reminds me of the BBC and the Crouches all over again, in which they, you know, they hired a white writer to go in there, and he made fundamental mistakes about a black family. He didn't know anything, you know, he didn't know about what, you know, he didn't know that we call priests pastors or anything else like that. He had no real knowledge of that, so it didn't feel right.
That's probably hit the nail on the head for me, actually. Yeah. Something felt really off throughout the whole film. It just didn't feel, it just felt off. And yeah, that's probably a big part of it.
The music I enjoy, but even that is dated as hell. I mean,
the 90s were a hard time for all of us.
Do you not feel, though, that in a way, I mean, when I was watching it, I wasn't sure what to make of it throughout a lot of it, and I felt like it couldn't decide whether it wanted to be a farce, whether it wanted to be a serious drama, whether it wanted to be, you know, a searing political satire. It didn't seem to know, and I don't think Beatty knew. I think he was just doing anything. What struck me, though, was how passive, oddly, he is all the way through. And it's like the character of Bullworth, it's like he's on a steamroller of just what he's doing is, he's like he's in a dream. And that, I took issue with the ending where he has that, like, 2-day sleep, and then he wakes up and he's back to normal again. And it's like, well, the whole point of what you were doing, are you basically trying to say that it's okay to say these things as long as you get vindicated at the end and then you die for your sins? You know, it was very much like, well, what message are you trying to give out? You know, because the message of the film and what it's saying and what it's railing against is as relevant today. It is a very 90s film in many respects, Chris, like you said, but it's as relevant today what it's saying as it ever was.
Yeah.
But I just don't know quite who Beatty was aiming it at, really, and what it was for, really, as opposed to just being a bit of a vanity project where he could do some terrible rapping.
Well, that's the thing, you know. If you mentioned, like, where's Aaron Sorkin come into it? It's got the rapping is very rat-a-tat-tat, and you could imagine Sorkin being the guy trying to do something like that. Not to say that, you know, what he came out with was good. What I'm saying is just the rhythm of it. But I don't know. I just find it. I lost interest the moment that the rapping granny from Don't Be a Menace came in here. In there. And I think one of the reasons why, as absurd as that film is, as a film, as a spoof, it seems to get the point across so much better because it needs a bit more absurdity in it. And I think you're right, Tony. It's not absurd enough to be a spoof or an absurd satire. And then at times it's far too serious for its own good. I think the ending, you know, it's Shaft remake ending, as I'd like to call it, where it's just like, just have a gunshot in there and to sort everything out, is just so on the nose and so it's so what Oscar, the Oscar board would love in a film. And I think that's probably and it got an Oscar nomination for its screenplay as well. And I think that's my big issue with a film like this, in the sense of it's so sermonizing. You've got Don Cheadle's character in there, and the way he comes in, and you're like, okay, fine, well, he's a certain type of character. Then he comes out with this sort of political aspect of it, and I'm just like, oh god. And I think the reason why I get so annoyed is show, don't tell. I think that's the big issue. There's so much of it that is so on the nose through the dialogue, as opposed to you know, this character Billworth doesn't view anything and then takes it on board as something and or anything else like that. No, what he seems to do is just he hears what people are saying and then just relays it out to a different audience, and it just feels it comes across as false. It comes, and you know, him as you say, Chris, he is so passive, and I've got a massive issue for passive protagonists a lot of the time. But it's one of those things where you just have a character, and of course he's supposed to be the eyes and ears, but he's so just like, oh, he can just waltz through things. And sometimes there was a point in time where he has that little spat with I can't remember which character. I think it's Halle Berry's brother. And he's having this spat, and he's given, you know, he's given the whole motherfucker this, motherfucker that, and he's just grinning, and it's just, it's so cringeworthy, because it's just so, there's an arrogance to it.
Well, you know the bit that got me for that as well, when Don Cheadle's doing his big speech to Beatty in his house, and he's talking really fast, and Bulworth just goes like that, as if to say, you know, stop talking like some sort of fast speaking black man, and I was like. And Don Cheadle just stops. And it's like he goes, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, really? You really? Yeah. You know, it's like, I mean, that's just, even for Bulworth's sort of complete daze, I just thought that was just so wrong.
It's the arrogance of the movie.
It's a very arrogant movie. One thing I would say about Don Cheadle, though, that I have learned from this, he's never aged a day.
That's true.
I don't know how he's done it, but he looks exactly the same.
That man,
that guy. I have
he's brilliant.
Even in this, where he's, you know, he's kind of doing this, you know, in the early 90s, around that time, he was only really found in films like this, trying to play. He played this kind of hot-headed character. Yeah. It's fantastic in The Devil Wears a Blue Dress.
One thing I do love about him is he's so consistent. Don Cheadle never gets like super praised, but he never gets anything negative. He's been consistently good throughout his career, which is something that I think is to be applauded in itself.
I would say one thing though, and I agree, except for one film, Ocean's 11, with his
Cockney accent. I forgot about that.
I like that too, for an ego trip. I love that film because it's such an ego trip, but it knows it's a movie.
Yeah,
throughout, and
he's still good in it. He's still good in it.
The thing is, like, you know, that it's a terrible accent, but those series of films know for a fact what types of movie they are. They are winking at the audience all the time, unlike Bulworth.
This is what this film maybe wanted to do, but it definitely didn't do it. Ocean's 11 is probably a much better way of... Because I think at one point, Don Cheadle blows something up and he says, "Blimey!"
Maybe if he'd done that in this film, it would have been better. But as a final fact, before we move on from Bulworth, apparently in 2013, a little known figure named Barack Obama said that in private he's talked longingly of going Bulworth. apparently, so make of that what you will.
You say that, but I think there's something to be said about someone like Barack Obama enjoying and liking this film and having that situation there. I think it's something to say about something like Bulworth. I can imagine him, because there's a lot of political aspect in there that is still being said. You can still hear this stuff being related. So the idea that Barack watched the film and wanted to just be as honest as he can, we're at the time of recording, we're saying this at a time where everyone's going a little bit loopy at the fact that he said "pop off" in a presidential speech. You know, I think it's something to be said about the film. If there is something to be, you know, at least he got something out of it as opposed to ourselves.
Well, that's some blessed relief. So that was Bulworth, nominated by Jay Everington, someone I know, I've known for quite a while now, on a writing website called MZPTV that we both frequented. He's at Jay Catalyst on Twitter. Yeah, he's a big political guy, Jay. He knows a hell of a lot about politics, so hopefully he'll get something out of this. So yeah, good nomination, Jay. Thank you for that. Moving on then, we're going to stay on the political arena, because we're going to use this as a segue to talk about the best and worst political movies that we've come across. We have some nominations for these from people on Twitter and on Facebook, and we'll get to that in a little while. But gents, what in your research, what did you find to be the best or the worst political movies, or at least the most interesting?
Well, I didn't realise, because I didn't think before this that I was into a lot of political thrillers or films, but it turns out I am. Like, you don't realise because you just put them down as thrillers, but when you go through the films you've watched, oh, actually, that is a very political film. Like, even with TV, House of Cards is a very politically driven thing, and I love that. But for me, the best one I can think I've seen, in recent years anyway, I really liked The Ides of March, you know, with Ryan Gosling, which I'd completely forgotten about, but Ryan Gosling and George Clooney.
I love that. Was that directed by George Clooney as well?
Yeah.
It's
his fourth film.
Cool. I really loved that. I don't know what it was about it, because it's a very dry film, but I thought it was a nice interpretation of American politics.
What was it about?
There was a campaign going on. I think Ryan Gosling, whatever his character's name was, as you can tell, I'm very heavily researched. I think he slept with someone on the campaign tour, and it all sort of spiraled out of control. Oh. And George Clooney. It was a good film. That's my one good film that I can remember from recent years anyway.
That's worth checking out then, definitely.
I would definitely check it out. If you like me, because I honestly didn't think that political thrillers would be something that I would be into, but that one is definitely one for noobs.
Mm. How about you, Liz?
How long have you got? When I heard that we're going to do this, I really like all types of films, and I in terms of favourites, I'll go straight off. My favourite, the one that always comes to mind for me, is Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. See, that's another one I forgot.
I'm a massive Kubrick fan anyway. I still think it's one of the most potent movies ever going about not only nuclear war, but how politics is handled, how we look at politics and the absurdity of politics and war, even so much so than the film that he did beforehand, which was Paths of Glory, which I also love. It gets difficult, because when you look at military films, they always have a political aspect to them. So stuff like Lawrence of Arabia, there is, you know, something running through that a lot. I'm a big fan of, this year I got on Blu-ray, and I think it was Masters of Cinema, it might be Arrow, but I'm not sure who the distributor is, but the 1931 film with Peter Lorre is a fantastic movie, in which Lorre plays a child murderer, and he's a paedophile and child murderer, and what happens is kids are going missing. And he and what happens is the town goes into kind of disarray because they can't find him. So it's kind of like a procedural, and the police are looking for him, but they're quite ineffective. What happens afterwards is you get the criminals, who get really upset, because what happens is the police start shaking them down. So the police, the criminals take it into their own hands in order to find the murderer. And what happens is, it's something that we still see to this day, the idea of you see an atrocity happen, and then all the opinions come out, all the worry and the fear and suspicion kind of comes into place. And it's, we look to certain things, we look to the authorities to try and help, and when they don't help, what do we do? And I think that's a beautiful film. It's more of a thriller than anything else, but there is a sort of broad politics that kind of flow through there. They're still not the ones I've decided to pick today. I decided to pick the first. I've picked two, and I'm sorry if that's breaking the rules slightly.
Nah, there was no rules. Go for it.
The first one I picked was The Manchurian Candidate, the Jonathan Demme 2004.
Not the original then, not the John Frankenheimer original one.
No, I love the John Frankenheimer one, and I think it's a really, I think that's a really good film. I love both versions. I think, you know, we're in a state at this moment in time where everyone's moaning about remakes, and then you come up with something like The Manchurian Candidate, and I actually really enjoy this movie as a remake. I think Demme puts across some really interesting and strong ideas of race, and the idea of politics being owned now, not by the candidates and not by the political ideologies that were in the 60s, but by companies and conglomerates. And I find that to be ultimately the most scariest thing because it feels too true. Not to say that it is, but it feels true. It's shot, I think, you know, Demme obviously has his visual, certain visuals, central framing and everything else like that. But it's filmed like a proper film. It's filmed in such a stand-up, normal, in a way that I kind of miss. And I really, it's a two hours ten movie, and it doesn't feel like that to me at all. I love the performances. I think Meryl Streep is fantastic, but I also love just the fact that you've got someone like Denzel, and Denzel's so good as a performer, and you see him in as a kind of schlubby, you know, that charm that we usually see him there is not really there, but he's still always so engaging throughout the film. And they also play about with the ending in such a way that it doesn't feel false. I really like that. I really like how it's brought across. The second film I just finished watching before we came on, it's Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one. What's that one?
I'm a massive Haneke fan. He is Austrian filmmaker, quite political, goes into a kind of philosophical elements with his films. He is definition of European art house to many people.
He did Funny Games, didn't he? He did Funny Games.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, that's a fucked up film.
Exactly.
Have you seen that, Chris? Have you ever seen Funny Games?
No.
No. Lock up Funny Games. Well,
I feel
don't.
Like I'm so out of my depth.
I love Funny Games. I love Haneke's films, and he goes into politics all the time. He's got 71 Chronicles of a Moment of Chance, which is not the correct title, I know, before anyone corrects me, but that's kind of what it's called, and Code Unknown, which deals with refugees, and it's both films are fragmented in a way that you see something really small occur involving maybe a refugee or a migrant, and they expand into greater things, and it looks all over the place. You know, it goes all over the place. They're great movies, but I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about The White Ribbon. One reason why is, one, I hadn't seen it until today. But what I love about The White Ribbon is it's shot in black and white. It looks like a Bergman film. It looks like Ingmar Bergman. Narrated by someone who used to live in this village. Allegedly, it's a fictional village, and these kids, there's a whole.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for, but you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A small, tiny village that lived in harmony for ages. And the kids go off one day, and they go to the edge of the village for some reason. And what happens is the doctor is coming back from a ride after, you know, to get ready to look after his patients, and he trips on some wire. So like a trip wire trips up his horse, he falls over, and this incident sparks off just a wave of mistrust. They wonder where why the kids were in the place that they were. They start looking at the serfs and the people who are working and toiling away and going, well, what was going on here? And it's just these small incidents that start to occur that start to arouse suspicion around the whole village, be it from the rich and the poor, doesn't matter who. And you see how women are treated as male authority type village, and it's set just before World War One in Germany. So therefore, it's about sowing the seeds of evil, so to speak. And it's a dark film. It's a really, really dark film. And it's just unbelievably scary throughout, in terms of nothing really, you know, these things happen within the film. You know, we're all so inclined to kind of try and find out who's done it. It's not really about who's done what. It's about how the tensions arise and suspicion comes through and worry and trouble, and how the village is never really the same again based on these incidents. And it's so for me, it's so absorbing. It's 144 minutes and you're in there with them. And that's one of the things with Haneke. He's a little bit like Gaspar Noé, in which where he goes, you're in here with me, you're in here with us, you're going to have to try and sit through this. And it's not a graphic film. It's not a particularly explicit film, but it's just quietly unsettling. One of the things is, as you know, it's set in just before World War One, and then at the end of the film, everyone goes to war. I'm not really spoiling too much. One, because there's many more incidents that happen, and two, it's very ambiguous. There is no answers, but it kind of hints at the fact that the children that are in the film obviously grow up to be the soldiers that become part of Nazism. It's that fear and suspicion of, obviously, that was, you know, set by Hitler after World War One, and you know, that sort of aspect that kind of lingers in there, but it's never said. And then we look at where we are today, and we look at everything that's happened in the last week at time of recording, and there's been so much in terms of opinion and memes and talk and suspicion and fear and worry and asking for retaliation and bothersome aspects of of the common man and who does what and people not being on airplanes and whatnot. And what Haneke does really well is he takes these things and he may set them in a certain period or in a certain setting, but he makes them so universal that it becomes very disturbing. I just think it's a fantastic movie for anyone that's so inclined. It won't be for anyone. Like I said, it does look like a Bergman film. It's set in black and white. It's luscious black and white, and it won't be for everyone. But I strongly urge people to try and have a look when they can.
Well, I'll definitely look that up. That sounds fantastic. There have been a few suggestions from people online. On Facebook, Matt Lathan suggested Team America.
Superb movie.
Yeah. Which is always a good one. Which, oh yeah, I love. I think that's a brilliant political one. Becca Andrews on Facebook also said Wag the Dog, which is the satire with Barry Levinson from the late 90s with Dustin Hoffman and Robert De Niro.
It's not bad, solid.
Yeah.
It's not too bad. That's all right. I'm not the biggest fan of it. I know lots of people that love that movie. But
Yeah, I quite enjoyed that one. Yeah, that was good. On Facebook, Andrew Brooker, known to many from Failed Critics, gave a few. He said the best ones he cited were Nixon, the Anthony Hopkins biopic, Frost Nixon, which was the Frank Langella, Michael Sheen face off. Which is also quite a good film, although I would argue the book's better. And Argo, which...
Ooh, I liked Argo. Ben Affleck directed that, didn't
he? Yeah, he did, yeah.
Is it the first one he did, or was it The Town was the first one he did?
Gone Baby Gone.
Yeah, it was his third one, I think. But no, Argo was a tremendous film. I thought that was fantastic, Argo.
Ben Affleck gets a lot of stick, but I quite like the guy.
I think he's if anything, better behind the camera sometimes than before it, actually, Ben Affleck.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, he's great. Brooker also said the worst ones. He named Bullworth. and he also suggested Bobby, which is the 2006 story about Robert F. Kennedy's assassination, written and directed by Emilio Estevez.
I do remember. I've never seen it, but I've heard it's pretty bog standard, pretty average.
It's got a good cast, though. You know, Anthony Hopkins, Lawrence Fishburne, Heather Graham, Helen Hunt, Shia LaBeouf. Lindsay Lohan, William H. Macy, Demi Moore, Martin Sheen, obviously his dad, Christian Slater, Sharon Stone, Elijah Wood. Ridiculous cast, but yeah. Also, Crawl Space Dweller Matt, great name, suggested The Interview, the last year's very controversial James Franco, Seth Rogen film, which was ultimately about as controversial as anything else they do when you watch it, which is not at all. So, yeah. Those were a few good suggestions on the internet. I think the one I would throw out, finally, before we move on, is All the President's Men, from obviously 1976, I believe, which is just, for me, brilliant. I love that film. I find the Watergate era incredibly interesting anyway, and what happened around that time, which, and Alan J. Pakula is one of the greatest underrated directors in Hollywood history for me.
He's fabulous, isn't
he? He's brilliant, and he doesn't get put up there with your Kubricks and your Scorseses and everything, but he's not far off those.
It's because he was really understated. Yeah. I think that's...
No, I think so. But All the President's Men's just... It's forensic. I love films like that. It's why I like Zodiac, because Zodiac reminded me a lot of All the President's Men, because of how forensically David Fincher put that story together. And All the President's Men is forensic, but it's also got that sense of character and that sense of drama. It's just really clever. I think The Parallax View as well was similar, and that was Pakula. And that was, again,
yes, it was.
Excellent film. Not quite as good as All the President's Men, but I think I like the films that really sort of depict the end of the American dream, and those are the films that sort of sum that era up, really. It's an interesting topic, political films. I urge you to go out and look at some of these we've talked about, because these films can often reflect a lot of things, and a lot of them are still relevant now, even though they were made 40, 50 years ago or further back.
That's what I find quite fascinating about it, that, you know... They are all still relevant.
Yeah, they really are. And it's you wouldn't think that, but I think, unfortunately, it says a lot about our society, really. But, you know...
The fashion isn't relevant.
Well,
yeah,
not that. Yeah, let's just skip past that and go to the theme. So, yeah, thanks to everyone who responded to us on social media for that one. So with that, let's move on and let's pick another flick. Babette's Feast is a 1987 Danish drama film directed by Gabriel Axel. The film's screenplay was written by Axel, based on the story by Isaac Dinesen, produced by Just Betzer, Bo Christensen and Benny Korsen, with funding from the Danish Film Institute. Babette's Feast was the first Danish cinema film of a Dinesen story. Dinesen's also known as Karen Blixen. It was also the first Danish film to win the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. Let's have a look at this one.
Barmhärtighet och sannhet mötas. Rättvisa och fröjd ska kyssa varandra. Människan tror i sin svaghet och sin kortsynthet att hon måste göra sitt val här i livet. Och fruktar den risk hon därvid löper. Vi känner fruktan. Men nej, vårt val är utan betydelse. Den tid kommer då våra ögon öppnas och vi omsider inser att nåden är utan ände. Vi ska blott vänta i tillit och mottaga i tacksamhet. Nåden ställer inga villkor. Och se, allt som vi har valt blev oss givet. Allt vad vi har avstått från blir oss beviljat. Ja, vi får också det tillbaka som vi har kastat bort. Barmhärtighet och sannhet mötas. Rättvisa och fröjd ska kyssa varann.
Blixen's original, or Dinesen's original story, takes place in the Norwegian port town of Bølvåg, a setting of multicoloured wood houses and a long fjord. However, when Axel researched locations in Norway, he found the setting was too idyllic and resembled a beautiful tourist brochure. He shifted the location to the flat, windswept coast of western Jutland and asked his set designer, Sven Wichman, to build a small grey village resembling a one-horse town. Marup Church, a plain Romanesque church built around 1250 on a remote seaside cliff near the village of Lundstrup, was used as a backdrop. I think that location history actually sets the scene for for the film, doesn't it? Because I really enjoyed this, and I'm surprised at how much I did, because as awful as this is to admit, I'm not a big foreign language film guy, but I really found myself appreciating what this film was. I don't know, what did you guys think?
Well, this film, I thought initially that I'm gonna hate this film. I started watching it, and you know what, it's all right. It's got a nice message. I like what it was trying to say. It's a little bit come down with me, but I'm fine with that. Yeah, because there's that whole bit in the middle where I'm skipping all over the place now, but they say, oh, she's gonna cook her French food. Oh, and they'd have weird, it takes a weird turn halfway through. At first it starts off quite bland, and this French lady, she comes over for reasons, and and she is the cook for these two sisters. And that wound me up a little bit, because they can cook themselves, but no, fine.
Yeah.
She does the cooking.
You can do all the chores. Yeah.
She can cook the brown stuff, because that's predominantly what they were eating.
It did look fucking awful, that gloop they were giving the old men. It's like,
fucking, it was awful. Ugh. And then she eventually makes this feast, and they all have weird nightmares about it, and it all goes a bit weird. And they say, we're not going to talk about it. They'll wait till they get in the taxi at the end of the Come Dine With Me.
Come Dine With Babette. Yeah.
Exactly. That's what it was. But in the end, it all turns out all right.
I just want to imagine the dining scene with the jaunty voiceover going, oh, look at the reaction there. Or something like that. Oh, look
at that turtle.
That turtle. mind yourself, Babette. Oh.
My reviews aren't as in depth. But I thought it was good. It was a good old laugh.
Good old laugh.
It was a good old laugh.
A good old laugh. And you see, and
everybody was happy in the end.
They were.
Although she probably shouldn't have spent all that money on all that food. But
I did think that. If you won the lottery, you don't spend it on a feast for a bunch of miserable fucking Christians who, you know,
want it.
Yeah, who don't even want the food, you know, and then moan. Only to discover that, you know, they actually quite like eating stuff that isn't brown shit, which is effectively the plot, guys. So, you know, enjoy yourselves when you watch this film.
Oh, come on, guys. I mean, let's be honest here. They've never tried that food before.
No, that's true.
That's kind of the point of it. This woman comes through from a very modest village that has never really experienced anything before. So, you know, for me, I very much in the same way as you guys. I found it watchable. I enjoyed it to a point. I wasn't the biggest fan of it. I think it took a little while to get into. And then when it gets to what it wants to say, I was like, okay, well, I kind of know where this is going. I think I do really enjoy what they say, or, you know, the ending, the final moments of the film, the idea that there's something about the beauty, there's something about something beautiful and needed and justified in art, whether or not people like it or not, whether people not understand it or not, and the idea that, you know, art should transcend, you know, certain aspects and such as money and everything else like that. And that's one of the, you know, and that's something I really enjoy. That's something I really like. And, you know, they are a bunch of miserable Christians, and I'm there going, yes, they are a bunch of miserable bastards.
The messaging was spot on. I thought everything it was trying to do, it did very well. I can't fault this film. I can't say anything was bad about it plot wise. All I can do is pick apart the bits that are funny. You know,
it's just a film that just is.
I think it was a nice film. It's interesting. Some interesting facts about it. The Nordisk Film Production Company suggested the cast of Babette's Feast should only include Danish actors to reduce production costs. However, the director Axel wanted Danish, Swedish and French actors to play the roles for the sake of authenticity, and I think he's quite right. The title character of Babette was originally offered to Catherine Deneuve, who obviously is the very famous French actress. She was interested, but she was concerned because she's been criticised in the past when she's attempted to depart from her usual sophisticated woman roles. And then Axel met with the actress Stéphane Audran, and he realised that she was Babette, really. And I think that's right, really. I mean, Catherine Deneuve's a great actress, but I think I'd never seen this lady before, but I think she was very good. I think she was very committed, and she gave a nice performance. You know, I liked her, and I wanted her to. I thought she was a bit of a a fool for actually being so nice to these people. But I think yeah. It was, yeah, you know, she, you know, at one point when they say, oh yeah, she's going to go back to Paris, I was like, well, yeah, fucking go back to Paris. You know, it's
with that bit specifically, like, she says, oh, is Zora ever go back to Paris? And they reluctantly say, yeah, you can go back to Paris. And then they have a meeting and say, basically, who's going to make our dinner?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what it is, really. Yeah.
There's a whole town meeting.
Yeah, you know, and it's like, well, but she, you know, I bought the role. And obviously, you know, we're joking, but there are a lot of good themes in this and a lot of subtext and things and a lot of character. But it was a good performance. It was a good central performance.
I thought, it might just be me, but she did look a lot like Jolie Richardson. Did you think that?
Yeah.
At any point?
Actually, she did.
I don't know what it was.
No, I can see that. Like a French Jolie Richardson.
French Jolie Richardson.
A little.
That's what I took away.
No, I can. No themes, no interpretations. Chris is like, yeah, she looks nice.
She looks like Jolie Richardson. Everyone likes nice dinners.
Oh, look at that! No! Put that away, Babette! Ooh.
That turtle.
I really want Come Dine with Babette now. I think that would be amazing. I really do. But yeah, it was a nice film. And I'm glad we were nominated a foreign language film like this, because I'd never heard of this one before. So, you know, I'm glad we did. Do you want to know the actual menu? The full menu that she serves?
Yes.
For it.
It consists of potage à la tortue, which is obviously turtle soup, served with amontillado sherry. And I think there's one point somebody goes, oh, amontillado. The old guy with the moustache, he's like, oh, amontillado.
There was a lot of facial hair going on.
There was. Hell of a lot. And a lot of, he was just the guy who was going, is there any more, is there any more wine? Yeah. Then there was blinis demidoff, which is buckwheat cakes with caviar and sour cream. I don't know what buckwheat is. Les, you're a chef. Do you know what buckwheat is?
The only buckwheat I think it might be a grain, but I'm also thinking of Buckfast, that infamous Scottish drink.
Tonic wine.
Yeah, exactly. I think that may, you know, kind of show why they interacted in the way they did after the feast.
Yeah,
but,
possibly. That was served with Veuve Clicquot champagne. Then there was Caille en Socophage, which is quail in puff pastry shell with foie gras and truffle sauce. Fucking hell, no wonder this cost her all her lottery money. Jesus.
I wouldn't mind that. That did look good.
Yeah, it did. That was served with Clos de Vougeot Pinot Noir. That was the wine that old duffer was asking for all that. the old duffer. An endive salad. Savarin arum avec des figues et fruit glacé. Jesus Christ. Fruit glacé. That was rum sponge cake with figs and candied cherries, served with champagne, assorted cheeses and fruits served with sauterne, and coffee with Villemarque Grand Champagne Cognac. Blimey.
And these people were only used to
brown
stuff.
Yeah, I was about to say, imagine going from the gloop shit to that.
Yeah.
And then the worst thing, going from that back to the gloop shit, which is what they would have had to do. I'd have been so... I'd be like, oh God, I can't do this. I bet they all threw themselves off the cliff.
Yeah. She's going to do it once she spent all her winnings.
Yeah, yeah.
Get used to your brown stuff again. You'll never have that night. That night was there. And but you spent the build-up for it, dreading it. Happens. An hour. Done.
Yeah.
Back to your brown stuff.
Brown stuff.
You've got Babette.
So really, you know, for all the nice messages, at the end of the day, really, she, you know, what she did was very cruel. Because those people have suffered.
In all honesty, I thought that film was really good. It was a lovely film.
So
it had a brilliant message to it. There's nothing bad about that film at all.
But you won't watch it again.
It's very funny.
A final little question for you guys. Who has identified Babette's Feast as his favourite film?
The guy that narrates Come Down With Me.
Who? Now, it can't be an American guy.
No, it's not an American guy. I know this is quite a broad question, but like, you know.
You know what? I think I've read this.
Go on then.
Ooh.
When you find out who it is, you're not going to be remotely surprised.
Richard Attenborough?
No. Although he is this guy is old, so I'll give you that. Although
Gordon Ramsay.
No. I'll put you both out of your misery. It's the Pope.
Right. Okay. Yes.
The current Pope, as in the guy Pope Francis. Who is currently in the hot seat. So, yeah.
I like the idea that it's a hot seat.
Oh!
It's his round.
Oh, it's your round, Pope. So, yeah, there you go. That's Babette's Feast, which I did really enjoy. So, thank you to Claire Tanner for that nomination. It's a very different one from what we've had. Claire Tanner at FilmBackClaire on Twitter. She is a production assistant, podcast junkie, cinephile, producer and co-host for at FilmBackTV. And she also loves ironic t-shirts, fun socks, sock monkeys and tea. So if you follow FilmBack at FilmBackTV, which is a podcast for striving and thriving filmmakers, do give them a look. Give Claire a follow. And big thanks for inviting us to the feast. Before we wrap up, I'm going to put Les through some misery because it's time for you to to take...
I thought this was not going to come up. I hate quizzes.
Which is, you know, naturally why you need to do one. This is the question time quiz. Now, Chris, you're welcome to jump in if you do know any of these questions okay. that are coming up. And this is based on the nominated film that Les suggested, which is Boogie Nights. Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun. I would have picked one that I would know more if I knew this was the case.
Well, you know, this is it now. You have committed yourself. So you have 8 questions on Boogie Nights, which is the 1997 classic by Paul Thomas Anderson. Brilliant film. One of the best films of the 90s. So it's a good choice. Les, are you ready?
Yeah.
I'm sensing a lack of commitment, but...
You've got to commit to a quiz, Les. Come on.
Yes.
Quiz time.
Yeah, quiz time. Quiz up. Quiz up. So, yeah, Chris, jump in if you know him, but...
I won't, you can grab that. I'll try.
Okay. Question one. Who was first offered the role of Dirk Diggler and suggested Mark Wahlberg for it?
Oh, why do I get the feeling? It's not DiCaprio, is it?
Ding, ding. Well done. It is DiCaprio. And he chose to do Titanic instead, which I can't, like, say that's a bad decision because it was a very successful film, but it's not as good a one. So... yeah, wonder what would have happened to Marky Mark if DiCaprio had taken this. Would his career have taken off? Who knows? Question two. How did Paul Thomas Anderson simulate the dialogue in the fake porn movies?
How?
Well, not the literal technique, but how did he make that dialogue happen? What was his choice?
I'm guessing it's real dialogue taken from actual porn movies.
Absolutely true. Yeah, it's real porn. It's real porn dialogue, which makes sense because it's terrible. So, okay, question three. You're doing well. Question three. What was the name of the 70s disco band who have a song the film's title comes from?
Oh, God. Keep on dancing.
Well, yeah. They've got a song, which the song is called Boogie Nights.
Is it Earth, Wind & Fire?
No, sorry. That was probably a tricky one. It's a band called Heatwave. Their lead singer was a Christian, and he wouldn't let them use that song when he realised the film was about porn and not dancing. So, yeah, there you go. Now, question four. Which real-life porn star plays Little Bill's wife, so William H. Macy, in the film?
Oh, God. Oh, it's the blonde... It's not Amber Waves, because that's Juliette Moore's...
That's the character, yeah.
It's not Tracy Lords, is it?
No, sorry. It's Nina Hartley.
Right, okay. I need to listen to more of the Rialto Report.
Yeah. You clearly haven't watched enough porn in preparation for this, Les. I'm disappointed.
That was the one I was hoping I would get.
All right, question five. What was Wahlberg's prosthetic appendage made of?
Was it of, like, luncheon meat?
Spam, yeah.
No, silly putty. Sorry, I'm sure silly putty.
No, it was actually a biodegradable rubber and foam combination.
I know he took it home with him afterwards.
He did, he kept his cock, which, yeah, you would. But it started deteriorating, apparently. So even massive fake dicks decay with age. There's something you've learnt there today. You know, I wonder if there's a Wikipedia article on that.
On fake penises? Yes, there is. I'm sure we'll find it.
You'll get there one day. Okay, question six. The character of Reed Rothschild names a fictional character people say he looks like. Burt Reynolds, who obviously played Jack Horner in the film, turned down the chance to play this character. Who is it?
Oh, God. It's a fictional character.
Yeah, and weirdly enough... Just today, I saw an article from Burt Reynolds, and it's not the character actually in this case, but he was talking today about a character that he wishes he played, but it's not the same one as this. But I'll tell you who that was in a minute. So who is it?
Well, I know that character is James Bond that he wished he would play.
That's right. Yeah, it's not this one. No,
but it's not this one. It's fictional. So America around the 70s. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it wrong to get one clue because I'm doing so badly?
Okay, I'll give you a clue. We are about to catch up with him.
About to catch up with him?
Yeah.
That's cryptic. That's a cryptic clue. I say that like I know where I'm going.
We're about to catch up with it. Mm. Sam Beckett, Quantum Leap.
No, it's Han Solo.
Oh, yeah.
we're about to catch up with him.
I don't like Star Wars.
There you go, yeah. Yes, he wishes he'd... He turned down the chance to play Han Solo, but he wishes he'd accepted the opportunity to play James Bond, which I think he got like in the early 70s. So, question 7, we're nearly there. How many times is the word fuck used in this film? Now, I'll give you...
Chris.
I'll give you an average for this. Go on, Chris.
97.
Right, Les, give me a number, and whoever gets it closest wins.
It's more than that. It's like Goodfellas amount of wow. Of swearing. It's either like it's between 197 or 250.
Pick one.
197.
You've got that, Les, I'm afraid. It was 165.
It was an outside bet.
Yeah. Well, not a bad effort, though. You were both right in that there was a lot. There was a lot of fuck. And finally, question 8. In what country was the film banned for 2 years?
Chris,
go on.
Ukraine.
No, but it would make sense.
You got to pick one, didn't you?
Yeah. Did you have all the countries in a hat and you just pick one?
Yeah, pretty much.
Les?
Australia?
No, it was South Korea, strangely enough. South Korea as well, which you wouldn't think necessarily, South Korea. Okay, out of 8 questions, you have scored 4. So that's not bad. That's not a bad innings.
That's not too bad.
That's not too bad. That puts you about halfway on the leaderboard. So, yeah, well done. Chris is currently at the bottom, unfortunately, of the leaderboard.
What did you expect?
You will get a chance. You will get a chance to you know, another second shot at this, so you can get the points up on a film that you like at some point. Yeah, because you haven't done that. But yeah. Thanks for playing. Question time. Right, well, that brings us to the end of this podcast, gentlemen. Thanks a lot. It's been a really good one, this. So I appreciate you both coming on. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Les, then, where can we find you on online? And what are you?
I'm kind of everywhere. You'll find me on Twitter through AfroFilmViewer.com. AfroFilmViewer. My blog is AfroFilmViewer.com. I write for Vodzilla quite often. I also write for the London Economic. I'm also on Geek Planet Online. We've got a new podcast. It's a monthly one at this moment in time, 6-episode monthly podcast called Cinematic Dramatic, and you can find that on iTunes.
And I thoroughly recommend that, because it's a really, really interesting podcast with two great cinephiles. So definitely look that up, guys. It's really, really worth your time. Chris, how about you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I host a Wiki Shuffle with my friends Jack and Phil. Every Tuesday, we press the random article button on Wikipedia and see what it throws up. You can find us on wikishuffle.co.uk or wikishufflepod on Twitter. And I'm Chris Wallace 123. And yeah.
I'm not just saying this because Chris is on the podcast. Wiki Shuffle is genuinely my favourite podcast out there.
Aww,
it really is.
That's nice.
And I listen to quite a lot, and I love Wiki Shuffle. It is just so good. I just go and check it out. You will laugh your head off for 40 minutes every week. So yeah, brilliant. Thanks, guys. You can find Pick a Flick at Pick a Flick Pod on Twitter, and we're also on Facebook at Pick a Flick. And you can email us any suggestions, any feedback, anything you want to say at pickaflickpod@gmail.com. Do get in touch. We're on Acast, who are our hosts. Please do stream us there, because they're awesome, and I get to see all the statistics if you do that, so that helps me.
We love stats.
We're also on Stitcher, who are also great, and they're hosting us now. We're, of course, on iTunes, and do like us on there. Give us a 5-star rating, because we're awesome. And thanks, actually, to Owen Hughes, because he has actually done that from Fail Critics. He has gone on there and said, yeah, they're good, and give us a 5-star. He did say more than, yeah, they're good, actually. But cheers, Owen, that's really good of you. But yeah, thanks for that in advance, if you do. We'll be back soon with some more flick picking. So once again, final thanks, gents.
Thank you.
No worries, thanks a lot.
We've been Pick a Flick. You pick him, we watch him. Simple. See you next time.